My name is Mike Titsy. I'm an alcoholic.
All right.
And y'all live a long ways out here. Of course, being with the alcoholic mind I have, I thought I knew better than my GPS system or Google Maps or any of that, because it said I was only 86 miles from here, but it was going to take me like an hour and 40 minutes or something, and I thought that just can't be. It's true. But, yeah, right when I turned off of 15, I thought, man, I would hate to drive these roads drunk, because those are some curvy roads. Nothing to it, huh? Yeah. One eye open. No, but then when I came up over a rise a few miles later and I saw the Blue Ridge Mountains over towards the left, and it was stunning. It was just beautiful. It's God's country out here, and it really is. It's a beautiful area. So thank you for inviting me, Sam. And I hope that, you know, I have something to say that will help someone. Again, I live in Richmond. I'm not from Richmond, but I got sober in Richmond. My sobriety date is January 25th, 2009. I have a sponsor. Who has a sponsor? And on and on and on. And I know up the sponsor tree, I don't know, two or three generations, if that's what you want to call it, and have their phone numbers, and if I ever need them, I know how to get in touch with them. But my sponsor told me early on, he said, you know, I may not always be available when you need me, so you need to cast your net far and wide. You need a support system. You need to get involved. You need to do service work. You need to do the things that I've done to stay sober if you want what I have, and I did. I wanted what this man had, even though he was 18 years younger than I was. And at first I thought, am I going to be able to pay attention to this kid? He wasn't a kid, but he had been sober about 8 or 9 years at the time when I asked him to be my sponsor. He didn't drink very long. He said he wasn't very good at it. He didn't really start drinking until he was around 19 or 20. And by 25, he had already hit bottom. So, but he had an honesty and a humbleness, and his shares just touched me, and he had something I wanted. And he's not my first sponsor, but he's the one that I've been with now for over 8 years. And, you know, he's really helped me out a lot. Like I said, I'm not from Richmond, but I got sober there. I'm originally from Houston, Texas. And, you know, I had what I thought was a normal childhood, and I never really thought it any different until recently. Well, when I did my fourth step, I started seeing patterns there. My parents divorced when I was about 12 years old, and, you know, things changed then. I didn't even know they were having a problem, and all of a sudden they split up, and then they're divorced, and our lives got really weird, sort of, compared to what it had been, because I'd always lived in the same house, gone to the same school, you know, and then all of a sudden it was just like somebody took it, shook it, and threw the dice out. And I started moving around. And this is what I'd never figured out until just recently. I was talking to a sponsee. It was like I went to three different schools in my sixth grade. That was the year my parents divorced. And then I went to, we called it junior high back then. Some of y'all might remember junior high. Some of y'all other younger people call it middle school now. But it started in the seventh grade, and I went to a school in Houston for the seventh grade, a school in Arkansas, which is where my parents were from, in eighth grade. We were back in Houston for my ninth grade, back in Arkansas for 10th grade. 11th grade, we were back in Houston. In 12th grade, we were in Houston, but then Mike started drinking sometime during then, and consequences started catching up with him, and so Mike got sent back to Arkansas on a Greyhound bus in the middle of the night so I could finish school up there, because I was not going to graduate in Houston. But that's another whole story in of itself. And so, you know, it was like I didn't know who I was. Who'd you need me to be? Because in Houston, I was just one of thousands of you know, kids enrolled in a single school. When I was in Arkansas, this town had like 200 people in it, and the classroom that I was in had like 12. The whole school probably had about 100. And so it was two ends of a spectrum that I was like jumped around or kind of knocked around in. But, you know, throughout all of that, I always knew I was loved. You know, I wasn't one of those who said, well, you know, my parents were cold to me and they weren't loving or whatever, and there was a lot of fights in our house. I never heard my parents raise their voice to each other. There was never alcohol in our house. There was never alcohol at any family events at all, Christmas, birthdays, reunions, nothing. There was never alcohol around me when I was growing up. I know that my dad had drank because I remember one night when I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, and I don't remember all the details, but I know that I woke up in the middle of the night. There was an ambulance parked in front of our house, and we were getting taken out of bed and taken over to the babysitters, and after that, my dad was allergic to alcohol. But he never talked about it, and so I never knew, you know, if he went to meetings, if he stayed sober. I know that he did not drink, and my mom said he hadn't drank since that night. And my dad died in 1991. I didn't get sober until 2009, so I've never got a chance to ask him. I have some older siblings, quite a bit older. I have a sister that's 20 years older than me, and she said he didn't go to AA, but he didn't drink. So I know that for a fact. And so alcohol was just never around growing up. When I was about 15 up in Arkansas with some cousins of mine, we were out in the woods somewhere. I don't know, doing what, probably, who knows what we were doing. But somebody had some 3-2 beer, and it was hot beer. I don't know what kind it was. But, you know, they handed me a can of it. So I popped it open, and I took a sip, and I was like, ugh. Handed it to my brother, who's a year younger than me. I was like, you can have the rest of that. I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. Later on that summer, I discovered liquor. And I liked liquor. Liquor's quicker. Liquor goes down really smooth. You mix it with Coke, Sprite, Pepsi. You mix liquor with anything, and man, you get a nice buzz on it, and it's cold, and it just tastes good. I also learned to smoke pot that summer. You know, my mom was moving us up to Arkansas to keep us out of trouble in Houston, and I smoked my first cigarette up there. I had my first beer, my first sip of liquor, and my first joint all up in Arkansas, where it was supposed to be safer to raise us kids. So, you know, you never know. But, you know, and I had some consequences in high school, but, you know, like I said, I almost didn't graduate from high school. But I dodged that one, you know, and that became the pattern that I was going to follow for years. I dodged consequences. You know, it was like they were coming straight at me, and I would jump out of the way through whatever means I could to dodge those consequences. I never got a DUI, although I got pulled over drinking and driving probably 4 times. Now, how I got out of that is just dumb luck, miracles. The cops didn't feel like, you know, being bothered with me. One time they just told me to stay. I was only 4 blocks from my house, and I pulled over and passed out. And they told me just to stay there, and they'd be back in about an hour or so to make sure I was there. Of course, I didn't stay. I went home, and I never heard anything else about it. You know, I got pulled over one night in Richmond, and I hadn't lived in Richmond very long, and I had an out-of-state driver's license, out-of-state tags, and I'd been out with some friends that I worked with, and I was the designated driver, and I was messed up because we'd been drinking and drugging all night. I was about 25, I guess, and this cop, I was on a two-way street, and when you cross this one street in Richmond, right close to VCU campus, it turns into a one-way going west, and I was going east, and I didn't realize it, And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the only car coming towards me is, guess what? A Richmond City cop. And so I turn off, he follows me, the light's going, and I was like, you know, I just got off work, I'm a bartender. Yep. You know, I'm smoking my cigarette, I got my sobriety gum in my mouth, and I'm popping it, and, you know. And I said, I dropped some people off, and I'm brand new in Richmond. I don't know my way around. And he believed me. And so, I dodged a lot of consequences like that. And so I never got introduced to any kind of recovery because of it. I patted myself on the back. You know, look how lucky I am. Look how smart I am. Look how smart, much smarter I am than that guy. When I left Houston, I did a geographic. I didn't know that's what I was doing. But, you know, I took a look at my life in Houston, and I didn't like the way it was going. You know, I was 21 years old. I hadn't gone to college. You know, my friends started coming home from college, and, you know, they were maturing. And I was working in the restaurant business, waiting tables, bartending, just doing whatever I could, hustling to get by. And, you know, I wasn't going anywhere. So I have a sister that lives in upstate New York. She had married a guy from up there when he was in Houston, after he got out of the Navy, and they had moved up there. And so I thought, I'll move to upstate New York. And I'd never lived, really, besides Houston and this little podunk town in Arkansas. I'd never lived anyplace else. And all of a sudden, I'm moving 1,500 miles away to upstate New York, where just my sister and her husband, who I don't really know that well, live. And the weather in Houston never freezes. The weather in upstate New York stays frozen from like November to April. And they owned a bar, and they had two apartments over the top of the bar, and I lived in the front one. And so I moved up there to clean my life up and moved above a bar, and, you know, I just picked right back up. I fell into the crowd that drank like I did, and there was a lot of them at this bar because they had nickel drafts every day. You could get really shit-faced for not very much money on nickel drafts. They were only 8 ounces, but you sit there and you drink enough of them. And anyway, you know, I did another geographic, moved to Richmond. Liked Richmond. I did get into college, you know, and I did finally finish college. I always say I was on the 20-year plan, and I finished a lot sooner than my plan, you know, I'd laid out. But I did finish it. I finished at VCU, and I was very, it took me a while, but I did it. I'd taken a part-time job at UPS back in 1986, and within a year, I had gotten a full-time position there, and I was trying to finish college, and you know, a part-time job became a career. And, you know, I had long stints where I did a lot of controlled drinking. You know, I would get completely bombed every weekend. But, you know, during the week, I would either just have a couple of beers and maybe a drink or two. Always smoked pot back then. I know it's an AA meeting, but, you know, I always smoked pot. And so, you know, I was able to accomplish what I needed to accomplish and keep my job. Then back in the mid-90s, I started working for a special division of UPS that I traveled a lot. And so I started traveling a lot. And that's a recipe for an alcoholic to really blossom, a budding alcoholic the way I was. Because I started, you know, I was in towns and cities all up and down the Eastern Seaboard and over to Mississippi. Didn't know that many people. Sometimes I'd be working with some guys that I knew, but a lot of times I would be there by myself. And so I started drinking in, hotel bars, and just really, I didn't have any adult supervision in my life. And then that got expensive. And I had a couple of incidents that, where some of my working colleagues saw me just absolutely blitzed. And they were shocked because I never hardly drank whenever I would be out with them because I knew I drank different. I always knew I drank different from the first drink, from the first time I got drunk. First time I really got drunk, I blacked out. And that was a pattern. I blacked out a lot. And so I started drinking in my hotel rooms alone. And I justified it by saying, well, I'm working. You would drink too if you lived on the road the way I do. And that worked for a long time until it stopped working. You know, when you're young and you've got a career going and you think you're on fire and you think you're it. Man, I thought I was it. And then I wasn't it anymore. And then the shakes started. You know, then I couldn't perform like I always had been able to perform in my position. And things started catching up to me. But because I traveled so much, and when I was in Richmond, I didn't have to go into like a UPS facility. I worked remote. I worked at home. And so, I could drink all afternoon and evening till I passed out, get up the next morning, turn my laptop on, turn my cell phone on, and boom, I was at work. And then I'd fall back into bed. I'd get up and I'd check my emails and I'd check my voicemails and I would respond to some of them. And, I did what I had to do to get by. That's the only reason why I never lost my job. Again, I dodged a big consequence because of the circumstances that was, that was part of me at the time. I kind of, 2008 was a terrible year for me. It was the year before I got sober. I think the entire year was my bottom. From January, I started making really bad personal decisions. About halfway through the year, I started making bad professional decisions and personal decisions. My home life was just toast. Everyone had just kind of just. That somebody went to Al-Anon. Yeah, I know. And they learned about detaching with love. And so I got enough rope that I started hanging myself. And I got promoted that year into a position that I didn't want. It was more money, more stock, more everything. I didn't want this position, though, because I liked what I did and I was comfortable with it, and I didn't like who I was working for. And all of a sudden I was being held more accountable. And that's when things just started unraveling really fast. In January of 2009, I was a mess. And, work was going nuts. My family had all but just disowned me. Everyone was telling me I needed to quit drinking. They were doing a lot of finger pointing. You need to do this, and this. And I would just tune it all out. At that point, I'd worked for UPS for 24 years. And so I thought that I could skate on that. And then at the that week before I got sober, the week before January 25th was a terrible week. I thought about taking my life. I got to the point where I couldn't imagine not drinking, or I couldn't imagine drinking anymore, and I couldn't imagine not drinking. I couldn't imagine living. I couldn't see beyond here. I couldn't see beyond 6 inches in front of me. It was just like a brick wall. And one Sunday morning, I was laying in bed, and I said, God, please help me. And I checked myself into St. Mary's detox that afternoon. I didn't really know what I was getting into. I really didn't know anything about AA except you people didn't drink, and I wanted to learn how to drink. I wanted to dry out, you know, kind of reset the old timer thing and learn how to drink like a normal person. If I could just dry out and start over, then I'd be okay. So, I checked myself in. I'd never been in the hospital since I'd been born. So that was a whole totally new experience for me. The last time I'd been really in the hospital was when my mom died back in 92 or 94. At first they didn't have a bed for me. I spent about 4 hours in the emergency room. They didn't have a bed, and they were trying to get me into their onto their psych ward in the detox wing. And I was leaving. I was like, well, you know, I tried. I'll come back tomorrow. I promise. I'll come back tomorrow. I was already making plans because I was starting to crawl out of my skin. I'd been there for a couple of hours, and I needed something. And right when I was getting ready to walk out the door, the social worker comes running around the corner and said, "We got a bed for you." And I thought again, man, I'm lucky. What a great coincidence. I didn't understand anything about God moments at that point in my life. You know, but I had to wait on the bed for a couple more hours, but they did start me on something to help calm me down, phenobarbital. Finally I got taken upstairs by a cop, and, they walked me into this, one area, and the doors behind me shut and locked. And then they walked me a few more feet, and the doors shut and locked. And I thought, ooh, this just got real. What have I gotten myself into? So I had to fill out some more paperwork up there, and I signed this. I don't remember anything I signed except this one piece that said that if I chose to check myself out, I couldn't do it for 72 hours. I remember signing that. I don't remember signing anything else. But that one stood out in my head because I thought, I got to be in here at least 72 hours. And so they put me into a group. I didn't even know. They said they were going to put me into a group. I was like, a group of what? Well, a group of people in the psych ward are sitting around talking on a Sunday evening. It's the detox section. And I'd never been in a group therapy session before. I've been to counselors that, in 2008, and they all said you need to stop drinking, and so I would go to a different counselor. And I'm looking around at these people, and I'm thinking, I'm in the wrong place. There was a guy that was sitting far from me to you. He's sitting there, and he's all bent over like this, and drool is coming down, and he gets hardly sitting in his chair, and he was my roommate. And he was detoxing on opioids, and he turned out to be a great guy, and we got along great afterwards. But I thought, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? I need out. I've been here for at least 72 hours. I signed that piece of paper. So the next day, the nurse came up to me and said, they're bringing an AA meeting, and we think you should sit in on it. And I thought, what the hell? Sitting in an alcohol detox facility, I might as well sit in on a AA meeting and see what they have to say. And these four old guys come trudging in, and I immediately thought, well, I don't have any, I'm not going to listen to this. I'll just tune them out, something. First guy that got up there, the first man that got up there and told his story, told my story. My exact story. He had never had a DUI. He had never lost a job. He had never lost a relationship, his house, his cars, nothing. He never had any of those consequences. And he'd been sober for 30-something years, which at first I didn't believe. I thought, nobody stays. You mean 30 years, you haven't had a single drink or drug? Or anything? I thought, wow. I mean, I already knew that I was an alcoholic, but I wasn't going to say I was an alcoholic. I asked for help, but I hadn't said I was an alcoholic. And with him telling that story and talking about AA, and then the other men that had come in with him talking about AA and a lot of the things that the program, you know, teaches us, I listened, and it made a difference. And so every day that week, I was there for 4 or 5 days. They brought AA meetings in every afternoon, and I went to a mall, and I listened. I found out about the year before, my doctor tried to get me to go to a 28-day rehab program over in Williamsburg. It's called the Farley Center now, but it was Williamsburg Place then. And, you know, at the time, I was like, no, I'm not that bad. But then once I was in St. Mary's, after 4 days, I did a door-to-door transfer to Williamsburg Place. And, you know, and there really I stayed dry. We went to AA meetings every day, or either the Williamsburg AA community brought meetings into the facility. Or they would, you know, load us into this big van, and we called it the druggy buggy, and they would take us to different meetings, AA or NA meetings around Williamsburg. And so, you know, but I just stayed dry, and I made friends. Nobody was from Richmond, hardly, that was there. They were from Northern Virginia, Virginia Beach, North Carolina, D.C. Didn't meet hardly anyone from Richmond. And it was okay. You know, I learned a lot about the disease of alcohol. And I learned some things about myself. And one of my biggest character defects is lying. You know, how do you tell if an alcoholic is lying? Their lips are moving. And so, you know, I decided that I was going to be as honest as I could be when I was in this facility. I was paying for it. Anyway, so I filled out this psych evaluation that my counselor had everybody fill out, and I filled it out as honest as I could, and a couple of days later, he had the results, and I tested for a spoiled child syndrome. And he gave me this packet called King Baby, and I was pissed. I was pissed, and I took it. And when we went for this group session that I was in, I learned a lot about group sessions, you know, over that first month. And this group session I was in, when we took a break, I walked down to my room, and I took that thing and I threw it across the room at my bed, and I said, "I'm not reading that effing thing. You can go to hell." Went back down after the break was over. Everybody in the whole building knew Mike Fitzhugh was King Baby. And everybody thought it was just as funny as could be. And so after, you know, that afternoon, I went back to my room and I picked it up and I threw it back down. I wasn't going to look at that. I was pissed still. That night when I went to bed, I picked it up again and I started reading it. And I was like, this is kind of like me. This is a lot like me, as a matter of fact. And so it was like the first time I'd honestly taken a look at some of the things that I had done in my past, some of the ways that I had acted. You know, I'd never done that before. I was like that alcoholic who came up out of the cellar. Ain't it grandma? The wind's not blowing anymore. I had no idea that there was, you know, all of this wreckage and chaos I'd created. And I really didn't understand it fully until I did my fourth step. But this was the first time I'd really, the packet that he had given me kind of had you take a look at your past and start identifying things. Another thing I learned in that facility that was turned into quite an educational experience was one day we were having some big, event, something, and we're supposed to be having it outside, but the weather was crappy. I was in there in February, and the weather was bad, and so they had it in this big auditorium, and they had the entire, everybody that was in Williamsburg Place there in this room, and we all had, there was a rope, all the way around the perimeter of the room, about a foot or two away from the wall, on stands, and we had blindfolds, and they said, there's a way out, put your blindfolds on, you know, grab hold of the rope, and, you know, start working your way around. There is a way out, and if you need help, raise your hand. And so, you know, we're all kind of bumbling and knocking into each other and working our way around, and I'm thinking, I'm going to find my way out of this thing, because I'm Mike. I'm it still. We're all bumping into each other and, you know, laughing, and then all of a sudden, I'm not bumping into anybody. It got real quiet, and I'm still going around and around. I'm like, everybody's getting out except me, I think. I don't know. I'm finding my way out of here, and all this stuff is going through my head. And finally, the counselor says, Mike, take off your blindfold. And I took off my blindfold, and everybody's standing over on the side with big smiles on their face. And they said, the way out is to ask for help. You can't do this alone. You have to ask for help. Man, that was eye-opening to me. I didn't know at the time that the first word of the first step was we. I didn't know that the first word of the big book was we. I had no idea it was a we program. I think that first alcoholic that told his story was so impactful to me because he didn't point at me and say, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do that. He said, this is what I did. This is how I got sober. I followed the person before me. I had no idea that it was a we program, that you had to learn to ask for help. And asking for help is really, it's really a difficult thing to do, and I still struggle with it. So anyway, I got out of Williamsburg Place and got back to Richmond, and man, I was on fire. I was ready to tell the world I was sober. I was ready to go around making amends. I was ready to save all my alcoholic friends. I was on fire. That lasted about a week, maybe two. And all of a sudden, I wasn't on fire. And I stopped meeting people. One of the first meetings I went to later became my home group, you know, and they passed the book around and all the men signed it with their phone numbers and never called a single one out of that book. I had gotten numbers from guys when I was in St. Mary's. You know, every day they would bring in the AA meetings. I never called a single one of those numbers. I never called. I started becoming the last one in and the first one out. I played that game for about a month. And I was crazy. And I was going to drink. And I desperately did not want to drink, but I didn't know what to do. And it felt like I couldn't ask anyone. Because I wasn't making friends. I wasn't meeting people. I still was isolating within myself. When I was in Williamsburg Place, we had to share, we had to be involved, we had to do all of this stuff because it was part of the program. You know, once I got out on my own, I think that's why I came out on fire, because I thought I could just carry that out. All of a sudden, it was me again, you know, and I didn't know what to do. And so one Friday night, I'd gone to an AA meeting. It was an early afternoon AA meeting. And I don't know, somebody shared something. I don't know what happened. But I left there. I got up, stormed out with a resentment against that meeting. So I went to another one, and I was supposed to meet someone there, this guy that had been trying to help me out. And I never saw him. The place was packed. And so I got a resentment. And so I left there, and I said, I'm going to go drink. Screw it. And I'm headed straight for, I was going to go buy a case of beer. I'm drinking. Screw it. And I was driving down the boulevard in Richmond, and I remembered there was, there used to be a place in Richmond called the Parish House. I don't know if any of you ever go to Richmond to AA meetings. It's right across the street from the museums, and they don't have meetings there anymore, but at the time they had meetings there every day and just about every evening. And I knew that they had one that Friday night. And so I stopped, and I pulled my car over, and I got my wear and went out, and I saw that there was a meeting there. I was only about two blocks away from it, and so I thought, well, I'll go to one more meeting. So I got to that meeting, and it had already started, and, when they asked if anybody felt like drinking, I raised my hand and said I wanted to drink. And, it was a good meeting. I didn't get a resentment about it or anything. But as soon as it was over, I was out of there before anybody could say anything to me. And I just rode around, I wanted to drink, but I didn't want to drink. And my desire to be sober that night was greater than my desire to drink. And that was new for me. And so there was another meeting that started there at like 10 o'clock at night or something like that. They had back-to-back meetings with, I think, about half hour in between on Friday night. And so I went back to it, raised my hand again, and said I wanted to drink. Good meeting. After the meeting, there was a girl, a lady that I had recognized and kind of knew from the morning meeting there, because that was going to become my home group, and I was going there more often than anywhere. And she came up to me afterwards and said, "What are you going to do right now?" I was like, "I don't know." She said, "Go home, go to bed, and I'll see you back here at 7:30 in the morning." And I said, "Okay." And I went home, and I went to bed, and it passed. And I got a sponsor that weekend. I was almost 90 days sober before I got a sponsor. And I'd met him my first weekend out. I'd had his name, his number. I'd never called him. I liked what he had to say. And I'd gone to a meeting that night, the night that I asked him to be my sponsor. Big meeting, hated big meetings, still don't like big meetings. Like at the Roundhouse when I was sharing, that's a big meeting. That's the first time I've been there in years because I just don't like big meetings. And I was standing up front talking. But anyway, he comes around, he gets coffee, and he sits right next to me. And I think, if I don't ask this guy to be my sponsor, I'm going to drink. So I asked him. And, I was crazy. I drove this poor man absolutely crazy. And all he was tried to be understanding, kind, tried to help me, went out of his way. And I was a total ass to him. And after a few months, he told me he couldn't sponsor me anymore. He said, "You're bad for my sobriety." And I was. I was bad for anybody's sobriety around me. I wasn't changing. I was still everything that I was when I was drinking, only I wasn't drinking. I was still, lies would just fly out of my mouth. Only now I knew it. Before I didn't even think about it. Now all of a sudden they would fly out and I would think, "Why did I say that? Why did I say that?" So I knew that he wasn't going to be my sponsor very much longer. So my current sponsor, I'd met and I'd listened to him, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he's really the one that took me through the steps. And he said, "I only sponsor the way I was sponsored. We'll meet every Sunday at 2 o'clock. That's your time. We'll meet for an hour. We'll read the book. We get to the steps. We'll work them. You know, call me every day. And that's what we did. 2 o'clock was my time every Sunday. Either he was at my house or I was at his house. He said, you know, if you need to cancel, that's fine. Just don't stand me up. And so I never did. Yeah, I had to cancel on him a couple of times. He had to cancel on me, but that's life. He did stand me up one time for dinner. This was just about a year or so ago. We were supposed to meet for dinner one night, and I was sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting. And called him, and I was like, Sean, you coming to dinner? Anyway, I kind of got off the track there. But at about 9 months, I had a new sponsor. I was still struggling with a lot of things, and I was still traveling a lot. And it was getting close to the holidays. I think it was around Thanksgiving. I'm not sure of the date, but I know that it was there was a lot of holiday travelers, because when you travel all the time, you can tell holiday vacation travelers from business travelers, because everybody's happy when they're traveling for holidays or vacations, and when you're traveling for business, everybody's pissed off that they're not home. And so there was a lot of happiness going on in LaGuardia Airport, which, if it's not Hell's Toilet, it's pretty damn close to it. It was awful. It was under being remodeled. It stunk. It was loud. It was everything that, you know, that would wreck a person's serenity. And I talked to my sponsor, and he said, I need you to read We Agnostics for something that I was struggling with. I was like, I don't want to read We Agnostics. And he said, read We Agnostics. I always carry around a pocket big book. And so I pulled out my big book, and I'm sitting there, and I'm reading We Agnostics in the middle of LaGuardia Airport. And when I got to page 55, where it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by pomp and by all kinds of different things. I'm not a big book quoter, but I think a lot of people know that passage. Something happened to me. Something changed. You know, I think that I was having going through what's called the spiritual awakening by working the steps with my sponsor, but that was my spiritual experience, because all of a sudden it got quiet in there. And it was like the whole world just shrunk down again, and I knew that whatever happened, I was going to be okay, that God was going to watch out for me, that I would be okay. And that was the first time I really had that conscious contact with the God of my understanding, and it changed me. It changed me. It changed my outlook on living sober. It changed my outlook on living and living sober. It changed the way I treated people. It changed the way I treated myself. It changed me. And, you know, I am so grateful that that happened when it happened. You know, at the beginning of this, you know, I said that I got, you know, my sponsor said he wanted me to do service work. I got involved in service work because I wanted to reach out and help other people. And so the best way I knew that I could was make coffee. You know, as soon as I was eligible at our meeting, we have a meeting at the time 7 days a week at 7:30. So the coffee maker has to get there at 6:30 a.m. every morning and has to have a key to get in. So minimum requirement, 6 months sobriety. As soon as I got 6 months sobriety, I started making coffee. And I loved making coffee. And then somebody said they wanted me to get involved with the Richmond has a New Year's Eve dance. It's a New Year's Eve party. I was like, man, that sounds like it's going to suck. It's going to be my first New Year's without alcohol. Ugh. I don't want to go to an AA party. She said, come on with me, you know. I got involved with Richmond Intergroup that year with the AA dance, and I stayed involved with Richmond Intergroup for the next 5 years. I did a lot of different things. I was an intergroup rep. I was the intergroup activities person that planned the New Year's Eve party and the Founders Day picnic. I stayed involved with my home group. I didn't like chairing meetings so much, but I have chaired my share of meetings. But I was the secretary, I was the treasurer, I was the anniversary person. I've always had a position within my home group. We have a lot of positions there because we meet so often. We're a big home group. And I started sponsoring guys. And that's really been the most fulfilling of anything, is being able to walk with another man on this journey as his eyes open, like mine did, as I can see him changing the way I did, where I can see him passing it on the way I did, the way that my sponsor did before me and his sponsor did before him. I somehow managed to hold on to my job, and in 2013, I turned 55, and UPS has for management people, 55 plus 25 years of service, you're eligible for full retirement benefits, pension, the whole nine yards, no penalties. And so as soon as I turned 55, I took it. I was sober 5 years. When I first came in, I was put myself on the five-year plan. I was going to stay sober for 5 years. I was going to retire. And I was going to drink. And I was going to tell everyone to go to hell. Just leave me alone. I got my little pension. I'm set. As 5 years got closer and closer, I had become a different person. But I still had it in the back of my head. 5 years. 5 years. You know, what am I going to do at 5 years? Early on, I read that story in the Big Book about the businessman who stayed sober for 25 years and then thought he could drink like a gentleman. And he was dead within a couple of years. And I was like, ooh, that's kind of scary. So anyway, 5 years came and went, and I stayed close to my sponsor around that time. I stayed close to my sponsees. I stayed close to my support system, and I didn't drink, and I didn't even want to at the time. And really, I probably kind of forgot about it during that time period, although maybe that's a lie because I doubt that I ever forget about that five-year plan. I did retire, and I thought, you know, what am I going to do? So I've always been interested in history, so I thought I'll get a master's in history. I didn't take a lot of history in college, but I thought, I like history, so I started taking some history classes at VCU to see if, you know, how I'd do, and I did great, and it was very interesting, and it was very expensive, and I thought, what am I going to do with this? I mean, really, I mean, it's fun going to, you know, being around these kids and listening to them, and, you know, they're enthusiastic and they're planning their careers. Well, my big career is over. And then there was a person that I talked to that had was doing, through J. Sargent Reynolds, the community college, substance abuse counseling program. And so I looked into that. And I'm just finishing up my last class, which is an internship this semester. I have two more classes. I've already finished my hours at the place that I did my internship, but I still go back there and volunteer and work one day a week with them. And I don't know if anyone in here has ever heard of it, but it's called The Healing Place. It's a men's recovery and homeless shelter. And it wasn't my first choice for an internship, but it's changed me. That's why I continue to volunteer there every week. I don't want to get too far away from it. You know, only by the grace of God that I'm not each one of those men that are in there that have lost everything. They come in sometimes with just the clothes The clothes they have on is all they have in the world, their families. We are the last option. If they want to get sober, there's a place for them there. And it's free. And it's about an 18-month program if you complete the entire thing. What I did was called peer mentorship. And, you know, when I first went in there, everybody was like, oh, we got another intern. You know, this guy's old. But I don't think they've gotten too many alcoholic interns. I think they were surprised that I knew my stuff. You know, I could talk to their language. I could relate to, you know, the other peer mentors who all came through the program. I could relate to the supervisors there who all came through the program. I could relate to the director there who came through the program. And I could relate to all the clients there who are coming through the program right now. And it changed me. It changed the way I feel about everything that I have. And everything that I have is only through God's grace. I know that today. You know, when I see these guys, I see them working and staying sober and struggling. And then I see some of them go out, and it breaks my heart. And it breaks their brother's heart that's been in the program with them. You know, they are together 24/7. They're tight. You know, I'm in there for 8 or 9 hours a day. And I get close with them. And just the past month, we've had just a lot of guys just go out for no reason. I'm sure there's reasons. But whatever they are, a lot of them that come back say they can't explain it, you know. And these have been supervisors that had been through the whole 18-month program, had been sober several years and went out. These were some of the peer mentors that had been sober over a year that was still living there. And working there and mentoring other guys and go out. You know, these are guys that I saw come, you know, from the day they came into intake through, you know, 5 months later sober, and they go out, you know. And it affected me probably more so than when one of my home group members goes out, because I don't know why, but it did. It just, you know, it breaks my heart. I want to wish them sober, but I can't. All I can do is continue to show up and, you know, speak the message that was spoken to me. Just like when Sam asked me to come here tonight, you know, I show up and I speak the message that was spoken to me. And I can see it's almost 7. I'm going to end, but I'm going to read something from Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It's on page 80 or 180. He's talking about Bill W. He says, of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regards to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. You know, and that's what we have over anyone else who's going to sit behind a desk. And, you know, granted, there's a lot of great, I've had some great counselors and some great help from those people. But there's something about when another alcoholic or addict is talking to you, how they can cut through all of that and say what you need to hear when you need to hear it, because I know that's what's happened to me. And so, thank you.